The prospect of the Labor Party winning office in the upcoming election has been a recurrent talking point at this conference, and hopefully people have gathered by now that while Socialist Alternative stands for getting rid of Howard, we have very little faith in the capacity of the Labor Party to deliver any real change. So the point of this talk is to look back through the history of the Labor governments we have seen and discuss a little bit about what it means for the working class struggle for our side. So I suppose to start with some general things and to start at the beginning. The Labor Party emerged out of the strikes, the strike wave known as the Great Strikes in the early 1890s that really swept Australia. And I won't explain why that happened, but the idea of the Labor Party, according to D.M. Charleston, one of the earliest Labor parliamentarians in South Australia, I think he was elected in about 1891, the idea was to achieve the complete emancipation of labour, to securing to it the full result of its toil. And once this was achieved by the Labor Party, he predicted that our fair land will indeed be the land of promise, flowing with milk and honey, and the cry of want will no longer be heard in the streets. They're somewhat more dramatic even than Bob Hawke's declaration that no child would be living in poverty by 1990. So the idea was that as the unions fought for workers' rights in the industrial sphere, so would the Labor Party stand up for their rights, be their representatives in the political sphere, and particularly in Parliament. And electorally, initially, the Labor Party's had, if you look at it compared to other parties around the world, quite extraordinary success. In 1889, the first Labor government in the world was formed in Australia, in Queensland. Now, it only lasted for about a week, but nonetheless, quite a significant indication of the rapid emergence of the Labor Party. The first federal Labor Party, led by a guy by the name of Watson, was formed in 1904, and it did somewhat better than the first government. It lasted for about 4 months, I think. And then the first real test of Labor in office, and what I'll get to later in this talk, was really the period around World War I. But by the time they got up to that, actually the fundamental nature of the Labor Party had been fairly clearly established. In fact, you can go right back to 1893 to get some kind of an idea of what the Labor Party stood for in the eyes of many militant activists. One of them, by the name of Arthur Desmond, wrote a poem in 1893, which is called Backing Down, which I quite liked. And it reads, "We place you there to fight for us, to free us from the bail of those who would our rights subvert, our liberties assail. And now, instead of royal deeds, your grovel shames the town. Our hopes are stranded once again. Our chiefs are backing down." And I think that poem truly does speak through the ages to frustrated supporters of the Australian Labor Party. Okay, so why is it that the Labor Party is like it is? Well, the mass support base, I suppose, in the Labor Party comes from the working class. And you only need to look, if people did it, the results of the New South Wales election last week to see that this is the case. While the Liberals polled 60+% in, seats like Vaucluse and in the North Shore, the richest seats in Sydney, the great sort of swath of suburban Sydney, working class Sydney, was, a mass of red on the electoral map. And, in some of the working class seats, the Labor Party polled on two-party preferred basis upwards of 85%. So mass support from workers, but the Labor Party doesn't, and it never has actually represented working class interests, because while it relies on workers for its support, it is in essence, I suppose, a party that represents the class interests of a different and distinct social layer, that is the trade union officials. The trade union officials as a group are not a part of the working class, and this is not a slur against the fact that they work hard or anything like that. Some of them do, some of them even care, genuinely about the interests of their members. Instead, it's a statement, based on the material class position that they have. Workers rely for a living on being able to sell their labour to a boss, and so a wage cut, is not just unjust, it hurts them not just for that reason, but also because their immediate life's affected. Actually, if you look at the trade union officials, they may have come from a working class background or identify with the class struggle on one level, but it's not their social role. Their social role is to collaborate and negotiate between the interests of labour and capital. And this means really accepting the system and working within its logic. And when it comes to a strike or another industrial dispute, what the trade union official wants is for that dispute to be resolved, and as well want themselves to be the guarantor of that resolution. The idea that rank and file workers should take over a strike well, this is not what the officials want precisely because, well, you know, then what's their role? They're redundant. So this sort of accommodation to the system is, I suppose, even more exacerbated when it comes to the Labor Party, and the Labor Party particularly being in government. Because actually it's not a matter that the trade union officials directly control the Labor Party or anything like it. Actually, the Labor Party, the way it functions, is an alliance between the trade union officials on the one hand and the middle-class parliamentarians who run the party on the other, and whose interests are one step removed again from the interests of workers. You know, one more step removed from workers than the trade union officials are themselves. And actually, when you talk about Labor parties that are actually in government, really, you know, the ministers, the leader of the party and so on that are involved in running the ship of state are closely, maybe not part of, but at least closely integrated and intertwined with the ruling class itself. Okay. I'm not going about this for too much longer. I suppose the other thing, just to quickly say on that, is that, you know, as well, just because you run the government in the sense of, you know, you're the parliamentary majority and you've got the Prime Minister and so on, far from means that you actually are running society or running, you know, the capitalist system. That actually the real, you know, runners of the system are, you know, the industrialists, the bankers, the heads of the public service, of the military and so on. And they can, as Labor governments like that of Gough Whitlam and Jack Lang have found, they can, if they so choose, very quickly indeed dispose of you. So really, it was once, you know, the Labor Party decided to commit itself to the parliamentary road, reject the idea of a revolutionary challenge to the capitalist state, that actually it A, became a pro-capitalist party, and then, you know, had to take on as a result of that all of the ideological baggage that goes along with trying to run capitalism. You know, most starkly in the case of the Labor Party, all the ideology of the nation, which in Australia meant, you know, adopting as one of their first principles the policy of white Australia, which they, you know, pursued for at least half a century. So, you know, the Labor Party runs capitalism when in office, does so, you know, just as much as the Liberals, as attack workers just as savagely as the Liberals, as I'll go through. But I think it's important to see that this doesn't mean that the Labor Party is just another version of the Liberal Party when it's in office. Actually, the trade union officials and even the Labor parliamentarians are not just free to openly pursue the interests of capital. Their organic connection to the working class movement doesn't stop them from attacking workers, as I said. Sometimes, actually, it means that they can attack workers more effectively because they have that connection. But it does change the way that they implement the rule of capital. And it means, interestingly, that actually, you know, you can see part of the distinction from the Liberals in that the ruling class can never quite bring itself to totally trust a Labor government. And this is a source of constant frustration to, you know, leading Labor officials who want to be part of the ruling class, who want to be part of the state and so on. I found a quote, an introduction to this book on the Labor Party by Neville Wran, the one time, he was the president of the ALP when he wrote this, but one time Premier of New South Wales, and he goes through at great length all the wonderful things the Labor Party's done for Australian capitalism. You know, we ran the state through the First World War, we tried to introduce conscription, we did it in World War II, you know, we smashed this strike, we smashed that strike, we, you know, started the US alliance, look at all the things we've done, and yet the ruling class just don't trust us. He writes, yet, and this is the great paradox, this tremendous Australian institution, the Labor Party, one of the few authentically Australian institutions, is still deemed in certain circles, especially extremely powerful ones, he writes, to be on trial, as it were, to its loyalty. And I think, you know, it's true, and it's a source of frustration to the Labor leaders, but I think also is an indication that, you know, actually, far from being just another version of the Liberals, actually they have a much more contradictory existence. And it's... And I suppose it's this contradiction of Labourism that not only makes the ruling class suspicious, but also means that class struggle under Labour rule can be quite different to under the Liberals, which is what I'm going to move on to now. Okay. Are you timing me, Tom?
Oh, yes?
Yep.
9 minutes.
Good. Just give me a brief five. Well, World War One, first of all, which was really, you know, a defining moment in Labour Party history. The Labour Party went into World War One under Fisher, declaring that it would fight to the last man and the last shilling, famously, to defend, not Australia actually, but to defend the British Empire. But within 2 years, the working class, which had, you know, begrudgingly at least accepted the war when it started, the working class had, you know, begun and was in the midst of, I suppose, I think the most profound and, you know, definitely the most widespread radicalisation that Australia has ever seen. You know, working rank and file militancy drove, you know, monumental strikes, starting off with economic strikes, but then, you know, political struggles and so on, that, you know, terrified even the most, you know, left wing of the trade union officials, the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World, and other socialist and syndicalist currents as well, rose to play, you know, a really significant role in mass working class politics. For the first time, as the struggle, you know, accelerated, there were, you know, rioters fighting became a sort of, you know, commonplace occurrence in Australian streets between you know, the right and the left battling to control, you know, the streets of Sydney, Brisbane, a whole swathes of rural Australia as well. And the driving force to this radical movement was the opposition to the proposal by the Labor Prime Minister Billy Hughes to try and introduce conscription. And a huge movement up and down the country arose to campaign for a no vote in the referendum that he was forced to call. And I haven't got time here to go through the scale of what happened, but just some of the things. In Broken Hill, which is one of the radical centres and one of the places where the struggle really, you know, workers started to go on the offensive, there were Labor volunteer armies of workers to protect, you know, anti-conscription meetings and so on from right-wing attack that numbered, you know, something in their thousands of people who, you know, signed up to these armies in places all around the country. And the radicalisation penetrated deep into the Labor Party itself. But under huge pressure, the union officials actually bent to support the anti-conscription campaign and were really, you know, the Labor movement was absolutely at the core of it. Now, many of the trade union officials who, you know, came out in the end to, you know, support the campaign actually were, you know, they were sincere opponents of the war, and many of them had been all along. There were even Labor Party MPs who, you know, sort of opposed what Billy Hughes had done at the start of the war and didn't like conscription. But it was when there was a radicalisation that they felt not only confident to come out and campaign, to come out openly, but they felt compelled to do so if they were to prevent, you know, a massive break to the, you know, of workers to the left of the Labor Party, if they were to prevent, you know, the trade union officials completely losing control, losing their control over the workers' movement. And so, you know, by putting themselves at the head of the anti-conscription campaign, the trade union officials reasserted their control, both their control over the Labor Party and, to some extent at least, their control over the mass of workers. And, you know, they had to go to quite extraordinary lengths to actually try and achieve this. Like, well, the most significant thing that they had to do, and, you know, you still think about it today and the scale of what they did, they expelled the leader of the Labor Party. You know, the Prime Minister at the time gets expelled by his own party, and not just him, also just they expelled Billy Hughes for being such a scumbag that he was. Actually, they expelled anyone who didn't support expelling Billy Hughes as well. They had to go as well. They had to make a clean break. You know, so a chunk of the, you know, probably not a bigger chunk in the end, but a chunk of the parliamentarians and so on who stayed in some way loyal to Hughes all had to go. And as well, they had to, you know, they had to put themselves at the head of this really, you know, at times almost insurgent working class movement that, you know, really brought Australia as close as it ever has to revolution. And the reason they did this in the final analysis was to protect their own position. It was the only way that they could stop things getting completely out of hand. To give people a sense of, you know, quickly some of the things they did. In the second conscription campaign, there were two. The second one, Billy Hughes introduced all these draconian legislation to make, it was basically to campaign against conscription, to campaign for a no vote, basically became, you know, virtually illegal. And so one of the ways that the Queensland Premier, who was against conscription, Ryan, tried to get around this was by reading anti-conscription, a speech against conscription into the parliamentary Hansard in Queensland as a way to, you know, try and get around the repressive legislation. And so, you know, read it into the Hansard, protected by privilege, and then mass distribute it afterwards. Hughes responded to this by threatening to send in federal troops to confiscate the Hansard in Queensland. And Ryan, in turn, issued an edict and empowered the Brisbane Industrial Council, version of the Trades Hall, the authority to raise a union militia to defend the state parliament against any attack from federal troops. So it gives you a sense of the, you know, the turmoil that was overtaking not just Australian society in general, but the labour movement itself. But in spite of all this radicalism, the fact was that only by creating, you know, a clear revolutionary alternative to labour could the workers' movement really go forward and start to challenge capitalism as a whole and really challenge for power. And, you know, as in many countries there are opportunities to do this, the most notable was the general strike in New South Wales and spread well beyond New South Wales in 1917. But really, the problem was that, you know, there was no real alternative. The closest to a viable alternative was the industrial workers of the world, I mentioned before. But actually, you know, their sort of syndicalist, anti-political orientation meant that they were incapable either of leading the New South Wales general strike to success or of defending themselves against state repression when the state came down on their head, framed up their leaders, jailed them, and so on. And the Communist Party, which was, you know, to provide a revolutionary alternative, at least for the early, in the early years, actually the Communist Party was still, at that point, you know, a year or two from its formation. Okay, so, you know, on one level, a huge success of the labour movement in opposing conscription, on the other hand, didn't go as far as it could have. Now, I haven't got time to discuss the next period of labour rule, which was the Depression, the Scullin years, laying in New South Wales and so on, but except to say that very much the same kind of characteristics of the World War One, you know, a period of acute crisis for the capitalist system, a period where workers were making increasing demands on the Labour Party, in which they had huge expectations of what Labour could deliver, and again, when a chunk of them started to look in the direction of a more radical alternative than the Labour Party. And this period really didn't end until World War II, which was the time when, under Curtin, the Labour Party actually managed to impose its discipline on the working class and actually run Australian capitalism really for the first time during a point of, you know, national emergency or whatever you'd like to call it, you know, through World War II. And so that was quite an important turning point in the Labour Party, that, you know, that they managed to do that without a mass break to their left, and a lot of that comes down to the role the Communist Party played in backing the war. But really, I suppose this started to change after the war itself, and so it's what I want to talk about at a bit more length now. Because I think part of the political point I want to get out of this section is to say that, you know, one of the most common arguments that's put forward by people who want to defend, you know, the right-wing policy, the betrayals of the Labour Party, is that they argue that, well, the Labour Party's held back by the conservatism of Australian workers, that, you know, the Labour Party would like to introduce socialism or at least like to introduce reforms, but it can't because, you know, workers are so backward, they won't fight, that, you know, the union officials will be left out on a limb by themselves, they'll be crushed, and so on. I actually think that this period is a stark demonstration not only of the Labour Party's capacity to turn on its own working class supporters, but also a rebuttal of the idea that Labour is right-wing just because workers are conservative. Because actually, the period immediately following World War II saw one of the biggest upsurges in working class struggle in Australian history. I'll just give people a quick quote from, there's an article in this excellent book by Tom Sheridan, who also wrote another quite long book about the Chifley years. And he wrote, "New South Wales, during the 20 months ending August 31, 1944, had 1,432 industrial disputes involving 588,951, precisely, workers, and resulting in a loss of 1.5 million man days. At times, and in that period and since, industrial disputes wholly or partially deprived the neutral citizen of meat, bread, laundry, newspapers, tyres, theatrical entertainment, hospital attention, buses and trams, coke for stoves, potatoes, restaurants, hot baths, country and interstate travel, and other amenities." So, there were a lot of strikes. And, you know, there's a real hostility and bitterness towards the bosses. The editor of the Victorian Employers Journal complained of a severe misunderstanding in public opinion as to the position of employers, deploring what he called the insidious viewpoint gaining currency that employers are exploiters. And although, you know, in the bourgeois press, sort of sinister communist agitators were, you know, seen as being the ones responsible for all the industrial unrest, actually, it was really, most people knew what the real story was. It was written in Jack Lang's quite conservative weekly paper, Century, which is, you know, quite, yeah, anti-communist, constantly reiterated the theme that even the most, you know, usually pacific sections of workers were prepared to take direct action in pursuit of their aims. And underpinning all of this unrest was really the consciousness of workers that was formed in the two decades prior to the upheaval. That workers felt that, you know, after suffering through the Depression years, after making, you know, huge sacrifices in terms of their lives and their livelihoods during World War II, well, now they had a right to get something back. And Tom Sheridan writes again that the attitude of organised labour was coloured by the desire for something akin to revenge, for a squaring of those industrial and social accounts left suspended with the outbreak of war. And as well as this, you know, sort of hostility, there was a feeling amongst workers, but also, you know, the capitalist class as well, that the upturn, you know, the economic upturn in prosperity immediately after the war couldn't possibly last. It was, you know, enshrined in the consciousness of people that another depression, the horrors of which people knew so deeply, was just around the corner. And so it was in this context that, you know, labour union demands, workers' demands for increased pay, you know, guarantees of their conditions and so on, were widely accepted by, you know, not just left-wing unionist workers, but really, you know, extending into sections of the middle class and so on, that labour had a right to improve its position. So what was the response of the labour government to all this? This is the Chifley government by this point. And Chifley, just to quickly say, you know, was no Kevin Rudd. Chifley had been a railway driver, involved in the 1917 general strike, you know, even though he was not a lefty or anything like it, you know, had a whole history in the union movement, and so on. When he was in office in the, I think it was 1947, he tried hard to nationalise the banks, and that's one of the reasons he's seen as being a, you know, Labour folk hero, of actually trying to implement some of the Labour policy. Incidentally, the reason he couldn't do that was because it was banned by the High Court, indicates something about the state. But on the industrial front, Chifley was determined that the unions would not get any of their demands, no matter how much support their demands had amongst workers. He was going to squash them. And really, there are a whole series of strikes I don't have time to talk about, but the decisive one was the 1949 coal strike in New South Wales. The coal miners, you know, historically militant union at this point, you know, headed by an alliance of Communist Party leaders and other militants as well. And they'd really decided, you know, for some of the reasons that I outlined earlier, they needed to decisively, you know, win some demands. They want a 35-hour week. I can't remember all the other things off the top of my head now. What else did they want? Oh, anyway, a series of demands. Workers voted by 9-1 in June of 1949, voted by 9-1 to go out on strike. And Chifley responded by declaring he would crush the strike or go in against the strike, boots and all. He introduced draconian and retrospective anti-strike laws, jailing union leaders and others as well for the foul crime of providing financial support to unionists on strike. And this legislation went so far as to make, you know, giving a striking worker credit at the local grocery store for his groceries, this became a jailable offence under the great working class Labor government. The father of Kim Beazley, to provide some insight, I think, into the politics of Kim Beazley, argued that the government prefers to coerce the community on the coalfields rather than to allow the community at large to be coerced by communists. And this was part of a hysterical media campaign against the miners. You know, Labor luminaries, people like Arthur Calwell, another, you know, great Labor figure, declared that all communists should be put in concentration camps when he was giving a speech in the Sydney Domain. And, you know, most notoriously, on July 27, 13,000 troops were sent into the open-cut mines. Now, the amount of coal that they could actually extract, because they weren't in there to, you know, shoot the mines, they were in there to act as scab labour, the amount of coal they could extract was quite minimal, really. And some of the reason for that seems to be that actually, you know, a lot of the troops were pretty sympathetic to the miners. There were a whole lot of incidents of, you know, lots of the machinery got broken by the troops, supposedly because of their incompetence. Well, not necessarily just that. So it wasn't they could extract all this coal, but it was more the psychological impact that this had on the strike. Not immediately on the miners. The miners are a very self-contained sort of community, you know, a whole, you know, history of, you know, remembering the massive struggles of the 1929, 1909 and so on. But really, amongst, you know, broader layers of the working class, the boss's offensive, combined with the fact that, you know, the effects of the coal strike started to have an effect on working class living, you know, working class lives, actually meant that in the end, you know, the strike was defeated, along with, you know, also, you know, about the policy of the Communist Party wasn't exactly perfect, but I don't have time to go into that now. Okay, so what do you say about this in terms of, you know, what it means in terms of struggle under Labor government? Well, one of the things is that it can mean that struggles under Labor governments, because they raise the whole question not just of confronting the state, but of confronting a so-called, you know, working class government or Labor-led government, actually makes the struggle a lot more political and potentially politicising. The Communist Party had, you know, really overblown expectations of what was possible, but it gives you a sense that they argued in the lead-up to the coal strike. They said the strike wave is not only beginning to embrace new sections of the working class and drawing them into active political life, but it's also resulting in exposing the role of the capitalist state and the Labor Party and its reformist leaders, and is opening up the way for the passing of the masses over to the side of the Communist Party. Now, this was total exaggeration of what was going to happen, but there was an extent to which it was true that, you know, the coal strike did expose the Chifley government, did expose Labourism was a tool in the hands of the capitalists and so on, and, you know, they did win some support from it. But I think, you know, part of the lesson is that just Labour being exposed is not just necessarily equal. You know, Labour exposed, workers turn away from Labour, workers turn to a massive, you know, socialist alternative and join the Communist Party or whatever the revolutionary group is. Actually, it's not that simple. And the fact that the coal mine strike was defeated actually meant, you know, profound demoralisation amongst workers. And as well, because it was associated with sort of virulent anti-communism unleashed by the Labour Party, actually it really was the beginning of the end of the Chifley government as well, because, you know, Menzies came to power at the end of 1949 campaigning hard on anti-communism, and even though the Labour Party had gone on endlessly about how it was fighting the communists, actually if you wanted a campaigner against communism, you know, pig iron Bob Menzies was going to be better at it than any Labour government could be. Thanks. Okay, so I've gone on already, but after this defeat, Labor wasn't to regain office for more than two decades anyway. Between 1949 and 1972, there was not a federal Labor government, and for people who've been agonising about 11 years of power, should think about that occasionally. And Whitlam was swept to power in 1972, as people might know, on the back of a wave of social unrest. It's time, indeed. And I think, again, the Whitlam government, in particular, I want to talk about the coup that overthrew him in 1975, again, I think highlights the more political nature, the potential nature of struggle under Labor Party governments. I think the other point I want to make out of this, though, of the Whitlam years, is that actually being able to sustain a real working class fight back and struggle is not just a matter of, you know, being industrially militant, but actually I think the Whitlam years demonstrate the need for, you know, a political organisation and, you know, political ideas as well as just you know, sort of industrial struggle. Because actually if you look from, you know, the defeat of the penal powers, the Clary O'Shea strike in 1969, there was a dramatic rise in the level of industrial struggle. In the years before Whitlam was elected, strike days rose to above 3 million. 3 million strike days lost in that year. And to get a sense of the difference, you know, compared 3 million to the last few years in Australia, it's somewhere in the range of 250,000 strike days lost, and that's even given, you know, a bigger population and so on. And, you know, 1972 and 73, the numbers dipped slightly, but in 1974, strike days rose to almost 7 million strike days lost in 1974. Possibly, I'm not sure people, other people, comrades might know, but I think probably an all-time numerical high. But with the onset of the world recession in 1974, the ruling class, you know, had been increasingly a bit hostile to some of the things Whitlam had been doing, and really this, you know, hostility rose to the point of apoplexy, as Tom Bramble puts it in our new book. The share of profits in national income fallen from between 13 and 15% to less than 10%, and the result, or the response, was a massive ideological assault by the ruling class and anti-Labor campaign in the press. And, you know, Whitlam did a whole series of things to try and, you know, appease the bosses. He sacked his left-wing ministers like Clive Cameron and Jim Cairns, you know, tried to restrain wages and so on, but nothing he could do was enough, and nothing he could do was quick enough, and so the result, as people know, was the coup, the sacking of Whitlam in 1975 by the Governor-General, and, you know, really by a united assault by most of the ruling class. There was response to this from workers. Well, it was, you know, that immediately after the dismissal, you know, the day after it happened, thousands of workers downed tools and marched through the streets of Australian cities, and I wish I had some time to go through some of the accounts of what actually happened, and maybe some comrades here who are involved can say, but, you know, stock exchanges were occupied. There was one story I was reading about, you know, a few thousand students stormed the News Limited building in Sydney and tried to blockade it because they were responsible for all the anti-Labor propaganda in the press, blockaded it, burnt what copies of the Murdoch press that they could find, and, you know, by the time this story got back to some of the news agents, they were telling their, you know, people, oh, where's my paper today? Oh, the News Limited offices got burnt down by workers and students, is what they were told. It was actually true. But, you know, there's this huge, huge insurgent kind of, you know, upheaval, strikes everywhere, and the demand for a general strike. And this is all despite the fact that Bob Hawke, the head of the ACTU, was calling for calm. But despite this sort of mood for action and for resistance to defeat the coup, actually it was Bob Hawke's strategy that won out in the end. What he proposed as the alternative to the general strike was that workers should all donate a day's pay to the Labor Party election fund to get, you know, Whitlam back into power and in the upcoming election against Fraser and so on. And so, you know, Whitlam had appealed to people to maintain the rage, but by sort of channeling and, you know, jamming this rage into such narrow confines of get the Labor Party re-elected actually dissipated a lot of that rage and was really the key reason the Labor Party was unable to even win the, you know, even win the election despite all the working class hostility to what Fraser had done. Yep. And so I think, you know, this really highlights that, you know, what I was saying earlier about the need for a political alternative. There are all these, you know, lots of leftists around. A lot of working class militancy, a lot of, you know, on-the-job experience and fighting the boss and so on. But this is different to taking on the ruling class, taking on an assault by the state, and being able to, well, how do we actually deal with that problem? And I haven't got time to now, because I've gone on, to go into what, you know, the best response could have been, but maybe comrades can talk about that in the discussion. Okay. Well, to finish on the Accord years, just briefly, because Labor, in the Fraser years, you know, the point of the whole coup was to drive down working class living standards and so on. Fortunately, Fraser couldn't do this either, because the extent workers did maintain the rage, they maintained the rage against Fraser. You know, there were bitter industrial struggles, bitter political struggles throughout the whole Fraser era, and really ended not with, you know, a victory by workers or a victory by the bosses, but really not just in a stalemate, but a stalemate where really both sides felt they couldn't win, they couldn't break through, and were sort of mutually exhausted. And so it was at this point in 1983 that Bob Hawke entered the scene once again with the Accord, and Labor promising, you know, to end the bitter years of class confrontation, to have national reconciliation, and, you know, to give the unions and the bosses, particularly the unions, a seat at the table of government in what was known, a policy that was known as the Accord between Labor and the unions, and or the government and the unions, really. And to the left, this was sold as, oh, this is going to be socialism in Australia because the unions are going to have a seat at government and so on. But to the bosses, it was posed as what it really was, a better way than class confrontation to actually drive down living standards and wages. And actually, the Labor Party was able to achieve, by collaboration, what the Liberals weren't able to achieve by confrontation. That actually, the years of the Accord saw one of the most dramatic transfers of wealth from workers to the rich in Australian history, saw the start of all the neoliberal reforms, or economic rationalism it was called back then, you know, privatisation and so on, all carried out by a Labor government. As well, you know, the Accord had the effect of decimating working class organisation. I haven't got time to go into that either, but, you know, most remarkably, I suppose, you know, imposed the Accord on the working class. And the, you know, unions and workers who did stand up, most notably to quite different sections of the working class, the builders' labourers and the airline pilots, who did try and stand up to the Accord and resist it, got brutally crushed again, you know, using the great Shipley precedent of using troops were used against the airline pilots and so on. So there was class struggle under this period of Labor rule, but it was defensive class struggle, and class struggle that nearly always ended in defeats. Okay, so I'll finish up. Well, what about today? Well, I suppose to draw some conclusions in comparisons, that, you know, Billy Hughes, Ben Shipley and Gough Whitlam all came to power during or shortly before periods of intense working class radicalisation and militancy, and hopefully I've given a bit of a sense of what that was like. And as a result, the governments were beset by strife, and in each instance, at least a substantial minority of workers began to look to mass left-wing alternatives to the Labor Party. And if you compare that to the Hawke years, you know, it's really in stark contrast. You know, came to power at the point the working class was exhausted, came to power with the backing of key sections of the ruling class, and actually the result of this was, you know, 13 years of retreat and defeat for the workers' movement in this country, the legacy of which we're still very much living with today. So today, the situation, I suppose, is somewhere between, you know, these two examples. Working class anger and willingness to fight has been, you know, on the rise for some time, and evidenced by the huge turnouts at the IR demonstrations and so on. On the other hand, strikes remain at a historical low point, as comrades mentioned in the talk, one of the talks yesterday. and there's still no Kohir left in the unions that can, you know, present, I suppose, or provide a fighting lead. The union officials, you know, quite disgracefully, I think, have done very little to mobilise workers against the Howard government this year. And hopefully, I suppose, one of the things I've tried to get out of this talk is it's not just whether Labor's in office or not that determines what kind of struggles go on. Actually, it's the conditions in which the Labor Party's in office, which is why I think, you know, our argument about the unions need to fight in the lead up to this federal election, they need to mobilise on the streets, is informed by some of this history that, you know, it matters what our side is doing when Labor comes to power. But I suppose I want to finish not with that general point, but just not with that narrow point, but a general one, which is to say that, you know, over the last 100 years or so, thousands upon countless thousands of, you know, workers, working class militants, activists, have looked to the Labor Party, and being the Labor Party, you know, and seen it as some vehicle to change the world. And I think, you know, we need to draw that history to be clear that, well, these people were part of the working class tradition and that, but they were fundamentally betrayed by the party to which they gave their allegiance. The Labor Party, you know, is the party of breaking strikes, the party of war, the party of, you know, bringing troops into the mines, the party of cutbacks, of privatisations, you know, the party that backed the Indonesian invasion of East Timor in 1975, the party that started the Cold War anti-communist hysteria in this country, the party of the White Australia policy. And there's no reason to think, you know, starting to look ahead, that Kevin Rudd, if he does come to office, will be any different, which is why I think the fundamental lesson of the whole history of the Labor Party and struggle against it is that actually it's about time we started building a genuine alternative to Labor. And I'll finish there.